Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2018-1814, State of Ohio versus Gerald Prendergast. For Mr. Prendergast is Victoria Bader.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Victoria Bader, and I'm counsel for appellant Gerald Prendergast. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are here today because the state wants to charge and punish a first offense as repeat conduct, imposing a more severe punishment for first-time conduct without an unambiguous mandate from the legislature. The statute in this case requires that an enhancement when an individual previously has been convicted of or pleaded guilty to certain enumerated offenses. And that phrase leaves us with one question. Previous to what? What must the previous conviction precede in order to trigger that enhancement? Must the previous conviction precede the conduct alleged in the indictment or merely the filing of the indictment itself? In this case, the lower court judges reach conflicting interpretations regarding the timing requirement of the previous conviction. However, the plain language of the statute dictates that a previous conviction must be entered prior to the newly alleged conduct and not the indictment in order to serve as an element of the enhancement. When interpreting the meaning of a statute—
Counsel, you just said the newly alleged conduct. That's newly alleged by the state, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the alleged conduct in this instance.
Yeah, but you said newly alleged conduct. So it was alleged after his conviction.
It was. That's correct. But my argument is that the conduct has to occur after the filing of the entering of a previous conviction. It cannot be for conduct that occurred prior to the conviction in another case.
Where does it say that?
So the statute says a previously has been convicted. Yeah. And that's what the court has to answer that question. Nowhere in the statute does it indicate what previously refers to, but in context of the statute as a whole, nowhere in the statute does it indicate anything about the indictment, but it does specifically discuss the violation. So previously, if the term previously is to be given meaning, it must be given meaning in the context of the timing and must apply to the conduct in this case.
Counsel, you said in your opening statement that the state wants to punish repeat conduct. Isn't it the case that they just want to enhance multiple forms of the same conduct?
And that's what the state's interpretation would allow here. However, the statute doesn't allow for the enhancement simply for multiple instances of conduct. Rather, it's for conduct occurring after a previous conviction. If multiple instances of offenses were charged at the same time in the same indictment or tried at the same time, we would have a very different result than in this instance we have here.
It's meant to deal with serial offenders, which your client apparently fits, correct?
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. I think that the statute is meant to be a recidivist statute and to allow for enhancements after a prior conviction and rehabilitative efforts have occurred. And that...
Well, that's not necessarily... I mean, you're reading a lot into the statute to say that its intent is to give someone an opportunity, or it only applies if somebody's gone through rehabilitative efforts and then fails and commits another crime?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my interpretation of this statute. And as this court indicated in State v. Smith, in that case, this court refused to allow for draconian sentence enhancements without an unambiguous mandate from the legislature for first-time offenders. And that's the exact circumstance we have here. The conduct which Mr. Prendergast was alleged in this indictment was his first-in-time offense that we're aware of, and his previous conviction was for second-in-time conduct. Clearly on the face of the indictment, he did not have a prior conviction at the time the conduct was alleged. Additionally, the existence of a previous conviction is an element of the offense and must have existed at the time of the alleged conduct. A criminal offense is not complete until the offender satisfies all elements of the offense. And as this court has held, when the existence of a prior conviction affects the degree of the offense, as it does here, it is an essential element of the offense that must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the offense of unlawful sexual conduct with a minor is complete when an adult offender has sexual conduct with another between the ages of 13 and 15. And if the offender has a previous conviction for certain enumerated offenses, then that offense must be charged as a higher level felony.
Why is State v. Brantley not instructive to us?
Brantley is not instructive, Your Honor, because it dealt with significantly different language. In Brantley, this court considered whether an enhancement was permitted prior to the filing of a conviction when the enhancement was permitted for each subsequent offense. And in Brantley, this court found that the statute does not use the term conviction, and a conviction doesn't necessarily need to be entered. Rather, it needs to be an offense after a first offense. And in that case, we didn't have the same timing issue that we have here. In Brantley, it was a first offense, a second offense, and then a conviction and an indictment for the second offense. They were charged in sequential order. So this court in Brantley or Smith has not dealt with this specific timing requirement and this timing issue, and that's the difference between Smith and Brantley in this case.
Well, doesn't it say one sentence there, although the second violation occurred prior to his conviction of the previous violation? Isn't that a timing, a temporal?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's okay. It says there under, if the offender has been convicted before his indictment, the second thereof, although the second violation occurred prior to his conviction of the previous violation. Isn't that the same temporal analogous situation we have here?
So the situation in that case was different, and this court was not interpreting the same timing requirement, like I mentioned earlier. And I think that case could be different or that decision may have been different if we had the same timing circumstances and the same statute that we have here. That statute only contemplated an increased sentence for each subsequent offense, and the timing requirement wasn't, or the timing issue wasn't the same, because he did have an offense and a second offense, and they were charged in sequential order. So I don't think that Brantley is necessarily instructive to this case, although it has similar language and similar rulings. I think that this court really needs to look at the timing requirement and the specific issue in this case.
Counselor, what if all the charges from the prior conviction and this case had all been brought at the same time?
If all of the charges had been brought at the same time, there would not be an enhancement in this case.
Would not be an enhancement, but your client would be facing, of course, more jeopardy, likely more. Had he been tried and convicted on all of the charges, there would not be the enhancement issue, but there would be multiple convictions, more convictions than he has now.
That's correct, Your Honor. He could have multiple convictions, and the court could give him the maximum sentence, could serve those sentences consecutively. He would be subject to a maximum of 18 months on each F4, and the court could use consecutive sentences to stack those on top of each other.
So theoretically, could he have gotten the same amount of time?
So in this case, he was charged with, I believe he was charged with two counts in the first indictment or the first case that he had, and two counts in the second. They could, and if he was convicted of all of those and they were stacked, he could have received approximately 6 years, 18 months on each of the four charges, I think would be about 6 years. For an enhancement, he could be subject to up to 8 years per charge. And that is an extreme difference in sentencing that isn't necessarily contemplated by the legislature. When they drafted this statute, the legislature didn't necessarily contemplate this unique timing instance, because in the normal course of proceedings and convictions, an individual commits an offense, is charged, is convicted, and then perhaps may commit another offense in the future. And that's what this statute was meant to punish, is repeat conduct after a conviction.
So what is it that, how can the state and the court ignore the prior conviction?
The state's not ignoring the prior conviction. The state
What you're saying is that conviction should not be used as an enhancement based on the fact that the conduct there actually occurred after the time, the conduct in the present case.
That's correct.
But the conviction is there. So, and if the statute allows enhancement based on a prior conviction, how is it that we, the court, the state, should treat that prior conviction? Because you were saying we should treat it as if it does not exist.
And it does exist for purposes of sentencing considerations for the trial court judge. However, it cannot be used as an enhancement because it is an element of the offense, and it has to have existed at the time of the alleged conduct.
The conviction had to exist at the time of the alleged conduct.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
The conviction had to have, why is that?
So,
because the Section 4 says, if the offender previously has been convicted of or pleaded guilty to a violation of the Section 2907.02, 03, or 04, other revised code,
or a violation of a former section, 2907.12, of the revised code, unlawful sexual conduct with a minor is a felony of the second degree. Doesn't say before, doesn't say after, it just says the conviction has to be meted upon the defendant previously, which is what we have.
And then the question for this court is previous to what? In Smith, this court considered the statutory language has been convicted
Wouldn't
of.
Wouldn't it be previously to the conviction that he's facing at the moment?
So in State v. Smith, this court found that the statutory language has been convicted of necessarily implies that the conviction occurred prior to the filing of an indictment. And this statute includes the term previously. If previously is to be given meaning, it must mean that it refers to something other than prior to the filing of the indictment. And I ask this court to find that it is prior to the filing or prior to the conduct alleged in this case. However, if this court does find the statute ambiguous, Mr. Pendergrass asks the court to apply the rule of lenity and adopt his interpretation of the statute. If the statute's language is ambiguous and the defendant's proposed interpretation is reasonable, the analysis should be accepted in favor of the accused. Here, the trial court and the Court of Appeals found the statute unambiguous but reached two different interpretations. The four judges below issued four separate written decisions with differing interpretations, two in favor of Mr. Pendergrass and two against Mr. Pendergrass. The split in the lower court and the inability to interpret the statute without adding or removing words supports a dissenting judge's view that this statute is at least ambiguous. Mr. Pendergrass's interpretation is reasonable because it gives meaning to each word in the statute and prevents unintended sentence enhancements for first-time conduct. Accordingly, if this court finds that the language of the statute is ambiguous, Mr. Pendergrass asks this court to find that a charge enhancement only applies to conduct committed after a previous conviction. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ketter.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The Second District Court of Appeals was correct in determining that the enhancement requirement of the unlawful sexual conduct with a minor statute addresses the sequence in which the legal proceedings occurred and not the order in which the underlying offenses were committed for two reasons. First, because the plain language of the statute is unambiguous, and secondly, because...
Let me ask you about that. When I look at the plain language of the statute, it says whoever violates this section is guilty of unlawful sexual conduct, and then it goes on to say if the offender has been convicted or pleaded guilty, then it's a felony of the second degree. Why wouldn't the most plain reading of that statute be that the degree of the defense is determined at the time they violate? You know, whoever violates this section. Why aren't we looking at it at the time they violate the section? Isn't that what the plain language seems to say?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The plain language of the statute indicates that the A section applies to the conduct which is prohibited.
How?
Because that sets forth the essential elements of the offense of which the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The offense is committed when the defendant commits each of those elements.
Okay.
When the indictment comes down, if the defendant has a prior conviction, then he has been previously convicted of a qualifying offense at the time of the indictment. And that is why he has the enhanced penalty section. And that makes sense, particularly with regards to child victim sex offenses, such as in this case. We have a lot of delayed disclosures, and that's very typical of child victims. The state has no control over whether or not a victim is going to come forward when they come forward. If we look to the situation specifically in this case, the victim of the first offense, the first in time offense, occurred, but she did not disclose that that happened until after the second in time victim came forward, the defendant was prosecuted, and he was sent to prison. It was only after he was sent to prison did the first-in-time victim come forward and the state was able to pursue new charges. That's exactly why the intent of the legislature, when they want to hold a defendant accountable for repeat violent sex offenses, such as this one, that there is that enhancement, that he has that prior conviction.
So you think the defendant in this case was held for repeat offenses just in reverse chronological order?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no doubt that the defendant has a prior sex offense conviction from the 2016 case. So that fits into the language of the statute, which only requires that the defendant has previously been convicted of a
qualifying. How do you know that's the legislature's intent? I mean, it seems to me there's two plausible legislative reasons for this. One is we want to punish people more because they've committed more crimes, but the second could be if you commit a crime again once you've been convicted. How can we choose between those two legislative interpretations?
Your Honor, I would submit—
Other than just you telling us you like one better than the other.
Right, Your Honor. And I believe that really addresses the second point that I was going to get to, is that public policy supports the intent of the legislature, which goes with this idea of if he has the prior conviction, regardless of when the offense has occurred, so long as that prior conviction has occurred prior to the indictment of the second charge, then that's okay. Because public policy for the sex offense, when you have a child victim sex offense, a defendant shouldn't be able to receive a lesser sentence just based on when a child victim discloses. The state has no control, again, over when a child victim discloses. The legislature has provided for instances where if it is a child victim, then the state is allowed to pursue charges for an extended period of time because of the idea of child victim delayed disclosures.
That makes complete sense, but wouldn't the purpose, arguably, of the enhancements part of the statute be thwarted if the idea is you're convicted of this crime once, ostensibly you get out, we want to deter the conduct, and so therefore, should you engage in this conduct again, and you're convicted, your penalty will be enhanced. That doesn't work for this scenario.
Well, Your Honor, with regards to that issue, the intent of the legislature and the purposes and principles of sentencing, deterrence is only one of those purposes and principles. The others are to punish the defendant and protect the public. We certainly don't want a child victim sex offender who's repeatedly committing offenses to be able to continue being out in the public. We want to be able to protect the children, protect the community from him. That is part of the purposes and principles of sentencing, and that is certainly a legislative intent for the proper interpretation in this case of the statute.
Enhancements, too? Enhancements are in that category, sentencing enhancements?
Yes, Your Honor. The sentence enhancement for charging this with the felony of the fourth degree, raising it up to the felony of the second degree, coincides with that purpose and principles of holding the defendant accountable for his actions, protecting the public because he does have an enhanced penalty now. So that follows with the whole purposes and principles of sentencing and the intent of the legislature for this statute.
Well, if we're going to start looking at purposes and principles of sentencing to figure this out and guessing as to what the legislature's intent is, doesn't that suggest we have to look at the rule of lenity, too?
No, Your Honor.
Doesn't sound very ambiguous when those are your points that you're arguing.
No, Your Honor. The point is that when you look to other areas of the statute, you take a look at the statute as a whole, not just the single portion of the language of the statute. It is unambiguous. And if you look to this is a charging instrument decision. So when you look to when a state has to prove that there is a prior conviction, you look to 2945.11, which says that the state only has to provide that the defendant has previously been convicted, meaning the name of the defendant, the case that he was convicted in, and what that offense was, in order to qualify as a prior offense, a prior conviction. In fact, the specific use of the language conviction rather than offense or conduct indicates that it is only necessary that he have a prior conviction at the time of the indictment. The defendant will be charged with the underlying offense, the A section, for whether or not he actually did the offense and whether or not he committed unlawful sexual conduct with a minor. When you get to the B portion of it, that's actually a special finding that after the jury or the court has found that he's an unlawful sexual conduct with a minor, then they go to the special finding, did he have a previous conviction? The terminology there is used to identify the legal proceedings, the order of legal proceedings which has occurred, not the order of which the conduct was committed. So because of that, the language that's used in the indictment, or excuse me, in the statute itself, corresponds with the proper interpretation that it's only with regards to legal proceedings. It only has to be committed at the conviction at the time of the indictment. And this is certainly supported by public policy. It's supported by the language of the statute itself. And the Second District Court of Appeals found that this language was unambiguous. And we would ask that this court to affirm the Second District Court of Appeals decision.
Counsel, had this been known at the time of the offense that he was convicted of, I mean, the initial
2016 case, Your Honor?
Yeah, the subsequent activity, but the prior conviction, Section 4B4 would not have kicked in. Would you agree?
That's correct, Your Honor.
He could have been simultaneously facing two charges rather than one.
He would have been facing
two different victims.
I think it was a total of four different charges.
Right. Two cases.
Yes, that would have been the situation had it occurred. B4 would not have applied because he didn't have a prior conviction at the time of those indictments. Again, this falls back on when do the child victims disclose? There's no indication that the state had any knowledge of the first-in-time victim at the time that the second-in-time victim was charged. And because of that, it makes sense to be able to charge the defendant with that enhancement when the second case came out in 2017.
Would it matter if the state had known of those first-in-time offenses?
Yes, Your Honor. Had the state known of them at the time, then the state would have charged them at the same time. However, that wasn't the situation here. And again, because the state has no control over when the child victims disclose, we have the situation that's available at this time.
What about had you known about the first-in-time offenses but made a decision not to prosecute either for lack of evidence, or you didn't think the case was strong, or you brought them in and dismissed them without prejudice? Had you known about them, would that change the analysis of this case?
It could potentially change the analysis of this case, Your Honor, and I think Judge Froelich's concurring opinion in the Second District Court of Appeals addresses that issue slightly in the sense that so long as there's not manipulation on the state of the charges and the sequence of events that occurs, then the language of the statute indicates that we only have to have the prior conviction. If that had been the situation where the state knew of all of the offenses, all of the victims at that time, then there would be a way to address it at the trial court level without regards to the state charging with the B4 section. However, at this point, the defendant has been previously convicted. He should be treated like the repeat sex offender that he is. We don't even know whether or not there might be another child victim out there who may end up delayed disclosing as well. So he already got the benefit of being treated like a first-in-time sex offender in the 2016 case. He shouldn't now be able to obtain that same benefit just based on how the victims disclose. And because of that, the state is asking that this court affirm the Second District Court of Appeals decision and find that the state can pursue the charges under the B4 section. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to touch base on the legislative intent. There are no Legislative Service Commission notes regarding this specific statute. However, there are other statutes. There are more than 250 statutes throughout the entire Ohio Revised Code that use this language. And the tampering with coin machine statute actually has a Legislative Service Commission note that directly addresses this issue. In that statute, it allows for additional punishment when somebody has previously been convicted or previously has been convicted. And the Service Commission note mentions that a first offense should be charged as a misdemeanor, and they would allow for a felony offense for each subsequent offense, despite the fact that the language of that statute is actually couched in terms of a previous conviction.
Counsel, doesn't that cut the other way? The legislature could have done that in this case, but they chose not to.
No, Your Honor, because the language of that statute reads nearly identical to this
statute.
But
there's no note attached to the statute that says this is what we intend.
That's correct. However, I think that legislative history assists with the interpretation in this case, because in drafting that statute for the tampering with coin machines and using the language previously has been convicted, it's clear that the legislature understood that these would likely be charged in sequential order.
I think that might be giving a little too much credit, but here's my concern with that argument. I'm not so concerned with what the legislature may have intended if the language is clear enough. So I'd rather focus on the language itself. And as I think has been discussed already this morning, the difficulty is that it does say previously convicted. Help me get over not looking directly at that language and saying it means exactly what it says.
Yes, Your Honor. So previously has to be given meaning in this context. And as I stated earlier, in Smith, this court already found that the language has been convicted means a conviction entered prior to an indictment. After Smith, the legislature went back and amended that statute to clarify, but didn't amend any other statutes in the Ohio Revised Code, specifically these statutes that contain similar language but also include the word previously. In light of that, this court must give meaning to the term previously and look at that and determine whether or not that also, if it is to be given meaning, it must be given meaning in context of the timing. Additionally, the state mentioned policy arguments and delayed disclosure. This, as I stated, this language appears more than 250 times throughout the Ohio Revised Code. We also have the statute of limitations that addresses the issue with delayed disclosure. I don't believe that the legislature drafted this specific language with the intent to prevent delayed disclosures because it appears so frequently throughout the statute. If there are no further questions, I ask this court to reverse and remand this case to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.